Hi, this is Tony Robbins again. Listen, I am thrilled to offer you this special tape on Personal Power 2, The Driving Force, which is really just a conversation with some remarkable people. This whole tape, by the way, is really taken from conversations I've had with people I consider to be my best friends, my teachers, my coaches, on subjects that I think are most important. And they all come from Power Talk, which is my monthly audio magazine. So if you don't want this 30 days to be the end, which I hope you don't, I hope you aren't sick of me, you see some value, then let me be your friend once a month where I can come in and give you the very best topics I know of in the areas that shape your life. And also let me introduce you to some extraordinary human beings, some of whom are friends of mine, some of whom are people I've pursued because I know they're geniuses in their category and I want to know what they have to share. So I go out and instead of just having that conversation personally with them, I have it personally and I bring you the best of it to your living room, to your home, to your car. So I've decided that there are three areas that I wanted you to have some additional information on values and really affecting your business, your career, and your life with Stephen Covey. Because Stephen is a man who absolutely lives his message. He walks his talk. He's a man of total integrity and one of the people I respect most in the world. So you'll be learning some of his tools, and it's a sample of a conversation we had in Power Talk, which, by the way, he said was his best interview to date. And we don't end there. I then bring in a second conversation in the area of health, because if we don't master that, especially the mental side of it, because very often we eat well, do well, but then we pollute our brains, and we don't really understand the power of thought. And how it shifts, how the power of emotion shifts our physical bodies. So we did a tape on this with you here at Personal Power 2, but I wanted to introduce you to one of the people that I respect most in this area, and that is Dr. Deepak Chopra. He is an absolute genius when it comes to understanding the physiology of human thought and emotion and understanding how it shifts us. So I wanted to at least introduce you to that. And then thirdly, I thought, well, we want to enhance what you know about your relationships. And also, to make sure that we have a balanced view and got a woman's point of view, I've also brought you Dr. Barbara DeAngelis. And I have a power talk I did with her that you'll love. And if you're involved in relationships or making it better, I'm sure you've heard of Dr. John Gray. He wrote that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and all the sequels that have come out of that. The conversation we had lasted about 3.5 hours, and it was constant laughter. So I think you'll not only learn from this, but really enjoy it. Again, you're just going to get a sneak peek into a little bit of our conversation. But hopefully enough here that it'll really trigger you, give you a couple of ideas, a couple little tools to give you an idea of what's possible, to expand what you think about relationships, about your career, about your values, and about your body, your mind-body effect. So I hope you enjoy this tape, and I hope at the end of it you'll write down some notes about what you think you can use from the principles you've learned from these great teachers. Hi, this is Tony Robbins. Welcome to the Power Talk interview portion. And today, I'm fortunate enough to be home, which I never get to do these interviews in, and I have the privilege of being with a man that I'm sure you heard of. His name is Dr. Stephen Covey. And I've been an admirer of Stephen's for many years. I feel like he is a force for good in the business community, and I think in our culture as a whole. He's one of those unique individuals that talks about honor and human dignity and character and who really lives it. And I have tremendous respect for you, Stephen, and I couldn't be more thrilled to have you be here.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's good to be in your humble abode.
Well, thank you.
We just, not much, we just call it home.
Yes, that's right, exactly. I want to make sure people know a little bit more about you, those maybe who haven't heard of you. You're the author of the national best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And what I love about you, personally, is that you're about one of the most congruent human beings that I know. And that's one of the things I value most. Your caring and your compassion and your desire to help people to remember that they're not a stimulus response being, but that they can choose the way to live. And that their need for contribution and interdependence, those themes I think are so important in our society today, and that honor is more important than things like moods or temporary desires. I've really tried to base my work on principles, values. You do the same. So I'd like to get into those, but I think before we do anything else, what I'd love to do, if you'd be willing to allow us, is find out more about your background. You know, in your books and in your tapes, we get to hear some of the stories about your family and some of the people you've interacted with. But maybe we could start out by having you tell us what shaped you, what's made you the man of the character that you are. What are some of the events or experiences that have given you these values and made you want to study this whole idea of effectiveness within human relationship and human behavior?
Well, I think the primary influence source would be my own family. My parents, my mother, for instance, was a person who had no respect. She was not a respecter of persons. In other words, there was no sense inside of her of preferring one person over another. Hmm. And then my father, he never was a person who would talk about himself and about his things. He says, because if you do, you might make other people who don't have those things or those opportunities feel lessened to some degree. Yeah. And he was modest, and he wanted to make a difference. And so he spent 15 years of his life producing a book to be read by 16 people, people of influence. And it did impact them. It was a powerful book.
And what was it called?
It's called The Revelation Monument Building. It was a recommendation for a special building to be built in a certain location to show how God deals with his children through art and architecture.
Wow.
In fact, it was all done anonymously. Anonymous service was a very key element of his life. And so these kinds of influences, I think, gave to me a desire that I want to make a difference, and also to make that difference in a principled way. And then I got into my graduate work. I really did a lot of kind of cramming in my undergraduate work. I find a lot of people did, you know, where you kind of read the tea leaves as to how do you get good grades with the least possible effort. And then I paid a terrific price when I got into my graduate work, and I was in a hospital in about 3 months with ulcerated colitis. I was about 21, I guess.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
I was trying to kind of make up for, oh, perhaps years of cramming, and I was trying to do it in a cramming way. And I started to get involved in the whole idea there isn't a quick fix in life.
Yeah.
And not to look for it, and to emotionally free yourself from it so that you can focus on something that really has permanency and that does contribute. I had a friend there who was a teacher in the university. He was a speech professor, and he was a very popular speaker and was used all around the country on the different circuits and so forth. And I said to him near his retirement, if you were to do it differently, what would you do? He said, I would build an organization. He said, I would empower so that there was something that had lasting value, that there was had carry-on and carry-through value. I also went on a mission for the Mormon Church over in Great Britain. And when I was there, my mission president called me and asked me to train leaders for small branches, we called them, that were the spiritual leaders of small groups of people. And I was just a young man at the time, and I had no idea of that potential in me. And he apparently saw that I could train leaders, so that became a very formative influence as well, his influence on me.
So his belief in you. You talked a little bit about some of the discoveries that you made with your own children. You're the father of 9 children. I should mention that
right.
as well. I thought I had my hands full with 4, and I was really accomplishing something, having an impact.
It's kind of like a daily laboratory, isn't it?
It sure
to
is.
To test your ideas.
every day, every moment. But tell me a little bit about your own children. But before I skip on to that, I guess I have so many things I want to ask you. Maybe I should keep chronological here. You went to work as a professor at BYU.
Right.
At the Marriott School of Management.
Right.
What made you decide to become a professor, and then how did that evolve into the 7 habits?
Well, when I did my undergraduate and then I did my mission work, I became very interested in training, developing leaders. So when I went to the Harvard Business School, I focused on the human side in the second year, where you were given a lot of electives. And then I decided we had a good family business going. It was a 3-generation business, but I think that my father really found most of his satisfactions working on that project I mentioned,
yes.
rather than from business. And it caused me to ask the question, oh, really, what do I want to give my life to? And I decided not to go into the family business, but rather to go into teaching people. I thought that teaching had high leverage opportunities, so I started to teach at the Brigham Young University, and I taught there for about 10 years. No, only for five years. And then I went on another mission to Ireland for 3 years. And then I came back, went into the administration of Brigham Young University, then back into teaching after a period of time. And then I decided I would really like to make an impact on the world. So I kind of distilled the essence of what I'd been learning working with organizations and people over a period of, I guess, about 20 years into the concept that private victories always precede public victories.
Yes.
And that out of true, deep character strength lies the power of both courage and compassion. And to me, the unique juxtaposition of courage and compassion is the essence of the foundation of an interdependency in the world. And so I became enamored by that idea, and I got into it, and I began to think, now, what would help produce, see, this private victory? Well, to take responsibility for your own life. So that's habit one, see.
Right.
And then, well, what is your life about? That's habit two.
Right.
And then to live by it, that's habit three. So in a sense, those three kind of fundamental ideas comprise the foundation for the private victory. Now, what's the public victory? Well, it's that you essentially regard other people with great respect and dignity and treat them accordingly. And how do you solve problems then? You have to listen to them first before you seek to be listened to. And then you try to go into synergy, which means you create something that is better than what either proposed initially. And out of those three represent the essence of the public victory, or the essence of interdependency, which is what life is. See, so then I started working with that material. You know how it goes. As you go out in training, you get a lot of feedback, and you hone the material. And
then you figure out how to keep that by reinforcing it through the,
right,
the whole idea of sharpening the saw.
Right, and sharpening the saw, that's habit seven. So then I decided, but I don't want to just be a speaker. I really want to get this thing institutionalized, and I want to see it has carry-on value, see,
right,
to really impact lives. So that's why I left BYU and went into setting up a business, and takes us where we are today, I guess.
Well, we have very similar goals. I had the same things that shaped me. I looked at people doing speeches, and I thought, you know, how long will the impact last? And as you know, building an organization requires a little bit more energy and impact and focus than just going out and doing the speeches, but it gives you the opportunity to continue to touch people. And one of the things I think you do uniquely as a communicator and a speaker is that most of the companies you work with, if I understand correctly, you come back and work with them over a period of a year. Is that correct?
That's one of the programs, yes, where we meet with them once a month for about 3 to 4 hours over a year's period of time.
Yes.
But the real key I have found is to train people inside their own organizations.
Yeah. Their own champions, if you would.
Yes, so that they then start teaching others, who in turn teach others, practice it, report back on their experiences in both teaching and applying, so that they start to get a sense of responsibility toward the material and accountability.
And momentum.
It does. It does create a momentum. There's a natural momentum of enthusiasm because it actually impacts lives. So when people come back, they say, what did you do? Well, I tried this circle of influence idea, and I just focused only on the things that I could work on. I can't tell you what that did to my marriage, or what it did with this teenage son that I've had nothing but headaches with.
Yes.
Or what it did in my executive team. Then they report, really? Well, it didn't work with me. Why did you do it? And they learn from each other. It becomes a kind of synergistic learning environment. So that, in a sense, my speech maybe was a catalyst to start it off. But in all sincerity, the power is when they do it with themselves.
Yes, I agree.
One of the little things I use in my presentations is a compass. And I ask people at the beginning of the speech to point north, to close their eyes and point north. And usually about, 30-40% actually have it correct. But that's the way it is with most people in most organizations. They really don't know where true north is.
Yeah.
Then I say, well, true north, you notice, is an external reality. That's what principles are. See, values are internal. Principles are external. And the key is to get our value system, which is the arrow of the compass. I gradually show that the compass never changes. True north never changes. But our value system is manifested in our habit patterns, and in an organization they're called our practices, is to get into alignment with true north or with principles. Then you get in harmony with the laws of nature.
Yes.
You get in harmony with what Carl Jung called the unconscious, the collective unconscious that pervades all humanity, regardless of their upbringing, their religion, their cultural heritage, their scripting, whatever it is. There is something far more basic and generic at that level than most people know about. And I find that no matter where we go in developing mission statements, if you get enough people interacting freely, feeling safe in the interaction, and where they're really synergistic, you know, where they're learning from each other, and also when they're very informed on the full nature of the problems in their situation, all the mission statements become the same. They all know where True North is.
So in what way?
They all basically describe not the vision part of the mission statement, what the, you know, what their enterprise is about, but the principles part of the mission statement always basically deals with four things: our physical being and our economic well-being. See, so the principle there is fundamentally to be fair toward people. And then the social part, that is having to do with relationships and the creation of a culture that has what I call an immune system in it, so we can handle any problems that come down the pike, and has this great ability to solve problems regardless. The principle there has to do with how you treat people. Kindness and dignity and so forth, and respect. To see people as a separate individual of equal worth to yourself. Then the third area they always deal with, inevitably, is how do you develop people? That's the psychological nature. How do you identify their talents? Then how do you develop them? Then how do you use them? That's the missing area in this country in most organizations, is how to use people's talents.
Yes.
The top people are being used, but the many other levels are not empowered at all. And that's why we have such a hard time competing in a global marketplace against major organizations from the Far East and from Europe that are more fully using people's capacities and talents. Then the fourth area has to do with, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? It's the spiritual nature. That is, are you making a difference? Do you really make a contribution? Do you add value? Does your life matter? In my next project I'm working on, I'm essentially bringing this together, and I'm calling it The Fire Within. You'd like that.
Yeah.
The Fire Within, to live, see? To live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. Wow. Trying to show how the four basic needs. And then I'm going to try to show how that pertains to every individual, every organization, and every society.
Fantastic. Tell me, you know, one of the major frames of reference that have shaped you is the whole concept of paradigms. Understanding that rather than just trying to change a behavior or a strategy or a single value, to really change the entire system, the entire way of looking at life, the entire belief systems. It's one of the things that we share in common. It's one of the things a lot of our graduates who are listening have experienced through Date with Destiny, a program that we do to make that kind of change happen. What I'm really getting towards is the 7 habits of success. Actually, we're talking about highly effective people. And I love your definition of effectiveness. Can we touch on that?
I like it because everyone resonates with it. Yeah. Just yesterday I was with a group and I said to a woman there, I said, you're a career woman and you also have a family. She said, yes. I said, how do you like to have a clean home? She says, well, I just don't, but I like it. I said, well, what would a success be to you? Wouldn't that be to have a clean home plus that your children do their jobs cheerfully without being reminded? And she thought, she said, oh, yeah, that would be it. I said, that's the definition of success. I use the word effectiveness to get away from the word of success because it tends to connote only getting desired results.
Right.
But you have to constantly nurture the assets that produce those desired results. So if your emotional bank account with your kids are high and you have win-win performance agreements and high trust, then you could have a box where you put money in and say, take your allowance out. And you judge your own performance. I always ask audiences, if trust is high, if the emotional bank account is high, are people easier or harder on themselves? Yeah. Always harder. Well, then where do we get the concept of external performance appraisal? You know, the old sandwich technique, say a few nice words, slip in the knife, areas for improvement, twist it a few times, the sandwich technique at the end. See, it's turning people again into things that you're manipulating. Why not become their servant, their helper, their facilitator, their coach, and instead of the sandwich technique, say to them, how's it going? Let them evaluate themselves. Now, make sure they have stakeholder information system data that comes to them so they're not just going on their own
self. So that people know what you mean by that. Can you clarify?
Stakeholder information system basically means that you gather data from the perceptions and feelings of the people that they interact with in a very systematic and scientific way. For instance, you wouldn't want to promote someone that didn't have high marks from their own direct reports.
Right.
That's a revolutionary idea. And from their bosses and from the other departments they interface with, see? That tells you they're a team person. Now, if you're only going to look at independent qualities, go ahead and promote them if they're an independent contributor. But if you're expecting someone to be a manager or a leader to have interdependency qualities, then you better gather information from all the stakeholders. I predict in the matter of a few years, the organizations that are not deep into stakeholder information systems, with all stakeholders, including the community, and suppliers, obviously employees and customers,
right,
will not be around.